like to bring to order the House Committee on Consumer Protection, Oregon State Legislature, January 24th, 2007. Today we'll be hearing public hearing on three bills, House Bill 2391, 2309, and 2096. On the schedule is also House Bill 2220. We will not be hearing that bill nor the possible work session today, so if you are here for that bill, I apologize. We will be revisiting that bill at a future date. Is there anybody that's come from a distance to testify on House Bill 2220? Thank you for that response. So at this time, I'm just briefly going to open a hearing on House Bill 2096 to receive testimony from Representative Chris Edwards, and then we will close the hearing and reopen it later on the schedule. Just some logistics issues. So at this time, I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 2096, and I'd like to have Representative Chris Edwards come forward, and Steve Dixon, our committee administrator, will give us a brief overview of the bill.
House Bill 2096 authorizes the formation of manufactured dwelling park nonprofit cooperatives, allows those nonprofit cooperatives to qualify for housing loans, financing, and technical assistance. Also allows Housing and Community Services Department to insure loans and regulates department provided financing for non-housing purposes.
So, welcome, Representative. Please state your name for the record, and we're anxious to hear your testimony.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Representative Chris Edwards from House District 14, representing West Eugene, Santa Clara, Junction City, Cheshire, and Alvador. And I really do appreciate, I know you're on a time schedule today, and so I'll try to keep my testimony to 5 minutes, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify on 2096 because I think it's an important piece of legislation this session. And I am here to speak in favor of the bill, House Bill 2096, which addresses the displacement of individuals from manufactured home parks all across the state. Now, tempted by increasing land values, many manufactured home park owners are selling off these low-income housing options to big developers. Now, when these sales occur, residents are often left without a place for their home or the means to move the structure. And I believe that it is time to address the problem of manufactured home park residents losing their homes due to land sales which are beyond their control. Now, this bill creates an even more a more level playing field for manufactured home residents as opposed to the status quo, which often pits low-income residents against developers with interest in the rising cost of land. Now, recently I had an opportunity to meet with one of my constituents who lives in fear of exactly the kind of displacement I've described. She expressed concern that she and her family would be forced to leave their home, and that in the event of a park closure, there might not be enough money to move. Fearing a domino effect, she wondered if moving into another park simply would prolong the problem and didn't feel confident that a new arrangement would be any more permanent. For this woman, without secure and affordable housing, every aspect of her family life was vulnerable. Where would she live if displaced? Would her kids have to change schools? Would she have to get a new job? Would there be enough money left over for health care after incurring the expensive cost of a move? And the list goes on and on and on. Hardworking Oregonians should be able to have the confidence in their housing and in their investments, and House Bill 2096 moves us in that direction. 2096 gives residents a chance to enjoy the benefits currently reserved for park owners and developers. This bill allows residents to invest in and benefit from owning the land their home sits on. By creating new nonprofit cooperatives for manufactured home park residents, House Bill 2096 allows residents to collectively purchase the park from the park owner and run the park themselves. This will give residents a more vested interest in maintaining the park and a lasting investment in their home. When residents own part of the land, it contributes to their equity and their ability to build assets, allowing their dwelling to appreciate rather than depreciate to zero, as is the case when the dwelling sits on traditionally rented land. This bill also updates the definition of elderly from 58 to 55 years old to match the Fair Housing Law. Likewise, it clarifies the terms of low, very low, and lower income, and allows the Department of Housing and Community Services to assist parks that are significantly comprised of low-income residents, rather than requiring that parks to which assistance is allocated be exclusively low-income. Now, in Oregon, there are more than 1,300 manufactured dwelling parks, 36 of which are in My House District 14. Manufactured dwellings make up an important segment of Oregon's affordable housing. A significant percentage of residents in manufactured dwelling parks are low-income and or senior citizens. It is important to note that the preservation of these parks is far less expensive than building new affordable housing. Park owners are not disadvantaged by the co-ops because they can still receive a fair market price for their land. Additionally, under current law, owners may receive a state capital gains tax waiver by selling to the co-op as opposed to a private developer. This will, without mandates, encourage owners to sell to co-ops, thus preserving an important affordable housing option. It is in the public interest of our state to assure affordable housing is available for lower-income members of our community. Residents should have the confidence of knowing that their housing is secure and that they will not be unexpectedly displaced from the land on which their home sits. With this in mind, I urge you to pass House Bill 2096 to grant security to manufactured park residents and their families while allowing the state to maintain low-income housing without increased cost. And I thank you very much for the opportunity to testify today, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Representative. That's alarming. You have 36, did you say, in your district?
36. The highest number of manufactured and mobile home parks in Lane County by House District.
So any questions from the committee? Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, I also have a few in my district. And one of the things I wanted to ask, does this bill give the residents, if they form this co-op, right of first refusal under this bill or not?
I do not believe that that's a part of this bill. And to some of the technical aspects of this bill, we do have the authors here.
Well, they're shaking their heads that it's not, so.
No.
Okay. Yes, we will have the agency coming up later in the committee. They're actually in a budget hearing right now as well, and so that's one of the reasons I'll be closing this hearing after Representative Edwards testifies.
Thank you.
So, you bet. Question, Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I thank you very much, Representative Edwards, for your testimony. I, like Representative Riley, also have some parks in my district. And my question has to do with the reality of I think this is a great concept and a good idea, but I wonder if you could talk about the land is usually very expensive in these parks, and are the owners, when they form the co-op, are they actually going to be able to raise enough money under this structure to make the purchase? is it going to be realistic? If the ability to form the cooperative is there, then is the reality also there if the land is so expensive?
Well, there is the capital gains waiver that exists under current law to encourage park owners to sell to associations or now, if this were to pass, cooperatives. So that is an incentive. I agree that just the financial being able to reach that financially is a significant issue. There are aspects that aren't necessarily embedded in this bill, but and again, the agency could speak more authoritatively to some of those issues. And I don't believe that this will be the only piece of manufactured home park legislation moving through the body this session, but this really specifically addresses the ability to form a co-op.
Thank you. Brief follow-up.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As one of the new Representative Edwards is one of the new young legislators coming in, I was going to give you a hard time about agreeing with the definition of elderly at 55, but I think I'll leave that alone.
Thank you, Representative Bonamici.
I wasn't aware of that. Any other questions from the committee? Thank you, Representative. It's a great segue into the rest of this hearing when we reopen this to get the technical answers to our questions. And I appreciate your advocacy in this matter. It's a big issue around the state. So thank you very much for your testimony today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee.
With that, I'd like to close the public hearing on House Bill 2096 and open a hearing on House Bill 2391. And I believe we have Representative Esquivel prepared to...
The elder Representative
Steve, would you go ahead and give us a brief summary of the bill?
Thank you, Chair. This bill requires the seller of real estate with a well supplying groundwater for domestic purposes to provide the results of the test to the buyer. Currently, they are only required to disclose the test to DHS. It also creates a maximum penalty of $720 for failure to provide results to the buyer.
Representative Esquivel, please state your name for the record.
Representative Sal Esquivel, District 6, Medford. Mr. Chair, fellow legislators, this actually I have back into LC because they had made an error with our intent. Our intent was twofold. One is this statute, this requirement, and what we're talking about in a water well is E. coli nitrate. This test has been required for quite some time, and it does go to DHS, and we want it to continue to go to DHS, but it's not necessarily is have to go to the buyer if it passes. But so I'm getting a change in here to change that back to DHS where it originally belonged. But more importantly, we have a statute that has no repercussions if you violate it. The penalty is nothing. So we did, I took it upon myself to do a class A, I believe, misdemeanor, punishable up to a maximum fine of $720, which means it could be anywhere from $720. It's up to the agency itself and the Department of Human Services. I feel that if we have laws, we, of course, need to have some sort of a way to make sure that that law is fully enforced. Now, in a contractual agreement today, it is a stipulation that if you do not receive this, then you can back out of the transaction. We may want to consider that because if we have a law that we're not doing anything with. Example, this one, we have no repercussions. But more importantly, I would ask the chair to indulge me when we bring this back to have Department of Human Services come in and tell us, what do you do with these reports? Because if they're doing nothing with these reports, I don't know why we're doing it. And that may be the better avenue, and to leave it in the contractual agreement that the individual, the buyer, can walk away from this if they don't receive that. And it has to be a clear E. coli nitrate. So if you would indulge me, Mr. Chair, and ask DHS to come in and explain that when I bring back the corrections and the amendments to this, I would greatly appreciate that if you indulge me with that. Because if they're doing nothing with it, I'm going to do something completely, completely different on this.
So, questions from the committee?
Question.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Esquivel, thank you for your testimony. I have a question. When you were deciding to get this bill drafted, did you consider a civil remedy rather than a criminal penalty?
You can now, in a contract agreement, if you and I, you were the seller and I were the buyer, you didn't provide me with a test, I could walk away from the transaction. I believe that's the way it's worded. That's really the only club. As for a civil, I suppose you could, but I mean, golly, don't we have enough things going on in our civil courts now?
Well, it would still be in the judicial system if it's a criminal violation as opposed to a civil remedy.
So well, that's usually just a fine, you know.
Other questions from the committee? Sal, I guess I'm if you could elaborate, I was kind of under the assumption that they're already required to, I mean, under most sales agreements, isn't that usually a requirement that the test results be given by to the buyer?
That's correct. And they can walk away from it if it's not adhered to, because it's a breach of contract.
So it's already a requirement that the buyer gets these test results.
It's a requirement, but it's not necessarily adhered to.
Okay. So you're...
And if you don't adhere to it, there's no repercussions if you didn't.
So there's no enforcement. So who would be enforcing this? Would it be
DHS? Yes, sir.
Be responsible for enforcing this?
Mr. Chair, it would be DHS. And by the way, I didn't know it, but DHS does all your meth homes as well.
Yeah.
No idea.
So, interesting. So they would have to, and would they be required to review real estate transactions in general to be able to accomplish this? How would they?
It's required, Mr. Chair, it's required in your closing that you have this form in there, and if the buyer doesn't see the form, the buyer can say, we're not closing this transaction. A lot of people don't realize that, but it is true. Now, but it is required by the state. We have a couple of state laws that are out here that are requirements in a closing of a transaction, but there's no penalty or repercussions if you don't. And I'm telling you, my industry itself, Mr. Chair, they probably don't like this because they're probably going to say, well, first of all, we do it anyway. Well, okay, that's what we're supposed to do, so what's the problem? The second thing they're going to say is, well, there may be some repercussions on down the line that we have not, that we may be liable for something. Well, if we didn't do our job in the first place, shouldn't we be liable for our actions?
Second part of my question is, if DHS is investing, are they going to collect the fine, and who gets the money once we do collect the fines?
Mr. Chair, I haven't researched that out, but one would assume that would end up in the general fund. Example, in the real estate agency, when there ever is any fines levied, those go to the general fund. It does not go to that agency.
Okay. Any further questions from the committee?
Just
I guess seeing no other questions, Representative, thank you for your testimony. This is a interesting bill.
Mr. Chair, I would ask also indulgence that when we bring this back with the amendments that need to be changed in here, that we do ask DHS, what are we doing with this information? Are we just sticking it in somebody's desk? Mm-hmm. Is it being registered? I'm not sure what happens to that information. And if we're going through an effort here and nothing becomes of it at the state level, then maybe we should shift this burden of responsibility between the buyer and the seller and keep the state out of it at that point.
Yeah, well, I can certainly ask staff to ask DHS that question. So make a note of that, Steve, with DHS on this issue. Thank you very much, Representative.
Thank you.
With that, I will. Anybody else wishing to testify on House Bill 2391? Seeing no other testimony, I will close the hearing on House Bill 2391 and open a hearing on House Bill 2309. Steve, will you give us a preview of 2309, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2309 requires creation of contractor bond requirement alternatives by Construction Contractors Board for nonprofit organizations rehabilitating illegal drug manufacturing sites such as meth houses.
So I'd like to bring the Construction Contractors Board. Are you wanting to open this up for us?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Craig Prinz, and I'm from the Meth Task Force. I had brought the proponents of this bill, and I was hoping I could have them come up together and speak to the bill, and then if CCB wanted to respond, they hadn't signed up. I didn't know they were here.
This was your bill?
Yes, sir.
Okay, I'm unaware. So go ahead and state your name for the
I will.
Record, and I will excuse you, Craig, and we'll let you come up in a moment.
Chair Holby, thank you very much. I'm just here to answer questions. If you have any, I'll be in the background. If you need me, give me a call.
Okay, thank you for that.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Craig Prinz. I'm the executive director of the Criminal Justice Commission. The Criminal Justice Commission, beginning in 2004, staffed the governor's meth task force, which Representative Smith is on, by the way. We were the governor's meth task force brought forth the kind of the basis of the legislation that became the meth bill last session. And this is an issue that we wanted to see if we can address this session. That's kind of a follow-up to the meth legislation. I asked Eric Page and Mitch Teal to come and give you the testimony. Basically, this has to do with when a house has been a meth lab and has been there's a process by which DHS flags a house that's been a meth lab. We had a group of people who took it upon themselves, basically as a civic duty, to rehab one of those, and they shared with the meth task force the issues that they came up against doing that as a nonprofit. And so I wanted them to, we put this bill in to deal with that issue of when a nonprofit seeks to rehab a meth house, what can we do about the bonding issues? Because they are treated as contractors currently under the bill. I just wanted to give the context and invite the gentleman to, I think, dealt with this personally. The context of this, as far as meth in Oregon, is that the meth legislation that was passed last session with the pseudoephedrine restrictions has really restricted or lessened the number of meth labs in Oregon. Current estimates are by about 80%. That being said, there are still meth houses out there that have been flagged as a meth house that are going to continue to be a problem. They're going to continue to be a basically under a community policing theory, a broken window in the communities, and are going to. I just wanted to have an opportunity for the folks who try to deal with that issue for the communities here to testify about it. Anna Peterson is also here. She's the founder of No Meth in My Neighborhood here in Salem. She's the chair of the Governor's Meth Task Force, and she's on the Criminal Justice Commission. So basically, those three are the people that I wanted to see if they could testify, and I just wanted to give you that context, Mr. Chair, and that the Meth Task Force supported this bill.
Thank you. Do we have questions of Mr. Prinz from the committee at this point? Maybe we'll bring up the
panel, maybe.
Eric
Page. Yes, sir.
And Mitch Teal was the other one?
Correct.
Mitch Teal at this point. Maybe you can just sit there and...
Would it be okay, Mr. Chair, if Anna Peterson came up as well and I could just...
Okay, then you can sit
thank
down.
Thank you.
Oh, that's okay.
Okay.
I apologize. I didn't see Anna Peterson's name down there as well. Thank you for coming here to testify on this bill today. It looks like a pretty interesting bill. It may have some good results, and whoever decides to go first, please state your name for the record.
I guess I'll start it off. My name is Mitch Teal. I'm a commercial real estate broker here in Salem. I own Commercial Investment Associates, 340 Vista Avenue, southeast here in Salem. And I was the 2000, what is this? This is 7 now, isn't it? I guess I was the 2006 president of the Salem Association of Realtors, and prior to that, the vice chair. It was during the 2005 year that we had a committee formed that we wanted to do something that would be significant in the community, as we always are involved in our communities, but step it up a level. And so we started talking about what that might be. One of the hot issues at the time, or probably the hottest issue at the time, was meth. And what we do is make our incomes from the buying and selling of real estate. So it dovetailed those two together and decided that we should look for a project house that we could rehab and both create funds to create a perpetual ability to contribute towards the community, as well as do some good work that is very visible and mentoring to the community. So we set out to look at decrepit, delinquent, abandoned, and otherwise ugly homes in the community that left a blight in neighborhoods. We're shocked to find out that there were as many as there were. And I loaded a committee in my Suburban and drove about town looking at some 20 or 30 of them in one day. At the end of that, we found one that we thought we had a chance of, because although it was obviously in bad state of affairs, it was not as bad as some of the others we saw. I put together a timeline that I've submitted today so that in your quieter time, perhaps you can take a look at it. But it, in short, and trying to be brief here today, is about an 18-month process in which to identify the property, worked with Saufield Greggs Law Firm and Eric Page here, helping us through all of the morass of details regarding the acquisition of the property. We formed a limited liability company, although we are a 501c6 as the Salem Association of Realtors, and we have subsequently formed a 501c3 for our charitable gifting in the community. In this case, we formed an LLC because it was uncharted territory. We wanted to create a little distance between us, our members, and our association, because we were messing with meth. And we didn't know exactly what we might find ourselves in the middle of, and had to proceed cautiously. Once Eric was able to help us form that entity and their office at Saufield Greggs, also we used Eric Jameson, who was with them at the time, we set out to acquire this property, did so on the Marion County Courthouse steps. We were able to control the sale and end up with the property. And if I recall, was $75,500, if memory serves. It was a little above what we set our cap at, but I got to make the call, so I went for it. Anyway, we had a myriad of problems, not the least of which was the CCB board and the requirement for bonding, which I'll get to in a moment. But many things along the lines of, you know, it's not easy to insure a meth house. And keeping in mind that you're taking over people's possessions, because when they're hauled away, everything is still left in the house. So now when you take that house, you get all the possessions with it. Just exactly how do you handle that? And where did they have grandma's gems hidden that will undoubtedly be worth $100,000 when they're no longer there? Issues like that, you know, were of great concern. We got the property sight unseen, another big problem in this rehab process, because you're buying a pig in a poke. You're not allowed to go in these properties, so you're just guessing from the outside just how bad it is on the inside. It makes the bidding process a little nerve-wracking. We finally had a decontamination done, only to find out that it had actually been done prior to that. So we kind of double-dipped there. Luckily, the contractor was gracious with us. Finally got pictures to see the inside and see just what a mess we'd gotten ourselves into. And then once we had the cleanup and a certificate of fitness from the State of Oregon Health Department, we were able to proceed with demolition and then virtually an extensive remodel. I wouldn't say reconstruction, but pretty darn close in some ways. Eventually, we were able to market that house and sell it. The organization, after paying all the contractors and a great deal of volunteer work from the association as well as some good business partners, we were able to come away with a little better than $32,000 net, as I recall, which sits in a bank account today waiting for another project. So I guess, long story made short, there were a lot of perils, a lot of opportunities for stub toes, but with good guidance, we got through that. And one of the big frustrations and the object of this bill, obviously, is that we were perplexed, to say the least, when we wanted to proceed rapidly and found out that we needed to do things like have bonds and so forth to really insure against ourselves. And we found that an individual was needed or a couple was needed to sign as a limited liability company or as a nonprofit, that we could not get a bond in the State of Oregon. And with that, I think I will pass the torch to Eric, and perhaps this is more in his genre, and let him take it from there.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I want to thank you today for letting me come before you to discuss House Bill 2309. Mitch Till has alluded to some of the numerous challenges that the Salem Association of Realtors experienced in tackling this process. And I'll pronounce my name for the record. My name is Eric Page, and I'm an attorney here in town at Southfield Griggs. The issue that's contained within House Bill 2309 relates to the definition of who a contractor is under the existing statutes. And the existing CCB statutes defines a contractor very broadly and then has a series of fairly narrow exceptions to that definition. And unless you fall within one of those exceptions, you're required to be licensed as a contractor before the CCB. And in this particular case, whenever you engage in any kind of activity that involves kind of repair or improvements to real property, like you did with this meth house, obtaining the certification to allow occupancy through DHS, as well as then to clean up the mess that ultimately was left there, including a lot of the improvements that were necessary to make the house habitable, you had to go through the process even if you weren't residing there, and even if you hired a general contractor that was already licensed with the CCB. CCB to go about getting registration and license with the CCB. And in that process, in order to become licensed with the CCB, you also have to obtain a bond. And the challenge that the Salem Association of Realtors experienced through this entity that they created, which, by the way, would be true if you were a nonprofit organization or otherwise, is that when you fill out the bond application to become a licensed construction contractor in the state of Oregon, you have to obtain a personal guarantee. And that guarantee requires some individuals to pledge their net worth or their personal worth to secure the bond and repayment of the bond obligation. And the challenge that arose, obviously, here is when you're dealing with something that's an unknown, as Mitch said, a pig in a poke, and you try to go out and find somebody who wants to sign a bond application under those circumstances, it's extremely difficult. What House Bill 2309 is intended to do is to remove creating that personal liability while still balancing and protecting the public by creating an alternative, and that alternative is to permit obtaining a line of credit or alternatively providing a cash deposit of some kind that would protect the interests, I believe, of what the CCB is intending to do by requiring, by having that bond requirement, but still allowing people to move forward and removing that impediment, if you will, that exists with regard to obtaining a personal guarantee when one becomes licensed before the CCB. I provided a more elaborate testimony that is before the committee that is in written form for you all to read at your leisure. And at this point, I'd like to turn the mic over to Anna Peterson to discuss a little bit more.
Thank you very much. And thank you, Mr. Chair, and the members of this committee for hearing this bill, 2309. I am Anna Peterson. I co-founded No Meth Not in My Neighborhood almost 4 years ago. It's our local meth fighting task force. And following that, I joined the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission and served since its inception on the Governor's Meth Task Force, which I have chaired for about 9 months now. But I'm really here as a citizen member. I'm a volunteer in all the things that I do that have to do with meth fighting and public safety. I'm here as a resident of this community who personally benefited because we had an organization like the Salem Association of Realtors who entirely on their own and of their own volition and energy and courage stepped forward to take a property that was a blight in the community and an eyesore in the community and a constant reminder to that neighborhood of the illegal activity and the dangerous activity that had gone on in that home. I'm here to say several things with regard to the reason for this bill. The reason is that it will help us as we use this project as a model to go around the state and carry the message to chambers of commerce and rotary clubs and civic groups, etc., that there are these blighted properties in their communities, but that they can be rehabilitated, and we can show the success story. I wish I could show you all the pictures today of that house and the way it looked in the beginning and the way it looks today, and now it has a happy family and a happy neighborhood with it, with that house. We want to be able to use this as a model project to encourage others to take the leadership that the Salem Association of Realtors took. But we know that in asking people to step forward and do this type of work under the existing rules, we're asking them to put a tremendous personal liability forward that many individuals and many, many communities simply can't foster. So I'm here to ask for your support for this bill and to tell you that your support for this bill and your support for encouraging communities and groups like this one will make a tremendous difference as we encourage communities around the state to return those blighted properties to useful properties, by the way, which would be on the tax rolls, not only providing housing, but providing a tax base as well. So I'm happy to answer any questions you might have. Thank you.
Questions from the committee. Representative Galizio.
thank you for your work and for coming here. And this is more of a curiosity question. I don't know if it will have any impact on the bill, but and I don't have in front of me the definition of, you know, the ORS for defining illegal drug manufacturing site, but the term rehabilitation, does that include, I don't know if there are any sort of parameters around what constitutes rehabilitation. From what I understand about what happens if you have a meth house, I mean, what's rehabilitation? Is that include just places just completely gutted, gone? I mean, that would still constitute rehabilitation of the site. Do you see what I'm saying? In other words, aren't the houses, they tend to be just gone.
Representative Galizio? The DHS has a series of statutes as well as regulations that have adopted in terms of what you have to do in order to obtain a certificate of occupancy once a house has been listed on the rolls. I know from looking at other articles on the subject that every state has a different standard in terms of what is habitable in order to get that certificate of occupancy. To Oregon's credit, it has one of the more stringent standards in the nation to deal with that, and I'm certainly no environmental expert in terms of how methamphetamine has an impact environmentally, but I don't know the answer. If you were to for example, raise the building and just build a new property on that site that would be a habitable structure, whether under the existing regulations that would be sufficient to obtain a certificate of occupancy, I don't know the answer to that.
Maybe I can add to that, if I may. I would tell you that I think it's a factor of economics. Depending on the neighborhood you're in, and having looked at 20 or 30 of these, in different neighborhoods we would have done different things in order to make that property habitable. It would have been silly to over-improve a property. In this case, it was a beautiful tree-lined street that everybody else took care of their homes. And in our mind, at the end of that, it had new siding where needed and roof repairs. It had all of the junk obviously hauled away, but to the point of a new lawn, underground sprinklers, all new shrubs. It's a very nice property when we were done, because that's what fit the neighborhood. Had we chosen some of the others, I think that we would have, instead of gone with lap siding, it would have been T111, and in some cases I think they were teardowns. We would have had to evaluate the property and said, you know, would it take more to fix this than it will to come out of the foundation with a new property.
Other questions?
I have a question, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Did I miss the part where you had to get a bond for this property?
Representative Gilliam, in this case, because the Salem Association of Realtors through this entity had to become licensed before the CCB. The CCB regulations require anyone who is a licensed contractor currently to obtain a bond. And so, you know, in the process of repairing, obtaining the certificate of occupancy and improving the property, they had to become licensed through the CCB, and as a registered licensee of the CCB, they in turn have to get the bond, and that's where the bond requirement kicks in. So it's a couple levels down in the regulations, but that's how you get there.
Perhaps I can add to that. In our specific case, we had to have our executive officer, Diane McLaren, and her husband, Mike McLaren, go in and sign and fill out all the forms for that. So we had to put an individual couple at risk so that our association could take on a high-risk project. And that seemed wholly unfair to them. We found out in this process that I, as an individual, couldn't without, if I were married, I'm not, but if I were, you know, the wife would have to sign on as well.
Right.
And if I hadn't been already divorced, that probably would have been enough to make that happen.
You know, I'm just not going to comment. But
a follow-up, Representative?
Yes.
I didn't get to.
Go ahead.
So, first of all, you know, thank you for what you're doing. And going through that. I just didn't understand if, in fact, you had to have that bond. Obviously, you went through that. So if you do, if we do are successful in removing this, is that going to You're going to be able to do about 100 projects next year in Salem?
I'm way too old for that. I would tell you that for other people in the community, and this is really where I see the benefit of this bill, that it's, you know, a statewide measure, and it makes it possible, as Anna pointed out so well, that all the Rotary Clubs and Kiwanis and any other group that wants to do this, to remove the barriers for them. This is one of many barriers, trust me. When we first met with the governor's task force on meth, we went through a litany of problems that we ran into, and at one point I finally, I think it was me that said, you know, let's pick something. Let's make some headway here, and this is the outgrowth of that a couple of years ago. I would tell you that, you know, the insurance issue is another huge one where, you know, the first quote we had in trying to get insurance on this property was $20,000 annually. We finally were able to secure, and it took us a month to do it, of diligent work. It took us, well, $1,500 is what we got, and a policy that had more exceptions than you can imagine. So, and really the bond, as it was explained to me, is ensuring the fact that if we had poor craftsmanship, if we built a deck out of 1x4s and somebody fell through it, that they would have the ability to come after us for that. Well, you know, we were, if anything, erring to the other side. Because of the association and the trade and business that we're in, we had to make sure that every I was dotted and every T was crossed and that everything was done above and beyond the level that any other contractor would have. Frankly, had I done this project myself, and I have done things like this, not a meth house, but a complete moving of homes and so on, I would have done it in probably one quarter of the time and three times the amount of proceeds, because I would have watched the nickels more carefully and cut corners where possible.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I also want to thank you for your contributions to the community. It seems like a wonderful project that's very beneficial, and we all know the serious problems with meth, and the step that you've taken is a step in the right direction. And I want to follow up, though, on what Representative Galizio was saying. It looks like the bill is narrowly drafted to apply to this situation, and I think that's good. I just want to establish that, that the use of the term rehabilitating in the bill, I want to make sure that that doesn't limit what your intents are. So I just wanted to make a statement that it's my understanding that you will have some, this kind of project, you'll have at least some discretion and not be limited by the word rehabilitating that's used in the bill. And then also I wanted to just briefly ask, I know there's somebody from the CCB here, and he's kind of back there nodding, but I guess I want to know if there's been any opposition to this. Thank you.
I can speak that I have heard none. It was well received at the governor's task force and proceeded through that smoothly. I think it's a no-brainer, personally.
Thank you. And I guess, Mr. Chair, can the record reflect that the CCB person is putting a thumbs up, so we have that. Thank you.
He'll probably do more than that. Representative Gilliam?
I have one more question, if that's all right, Mr. Chair.
Please.
This sounds very positive to me, and I think it's such a great thing that you're doing. You raise a question when you say, okay, let me see if I can put it this way. What if we have some other good-minded charities who want to help do this, and they don't have the connections, the professional expertise that you have in the industry? Do you foresee a problem removing this hurdle and then having a charity without that kind of experience getting involved and being over their head, and then the bonding requirements not there, where it actually might protect, you know, the other way around?
I suppose that could happen. I would think that before anybody would jump into a project like this, that they would research it fully, I would hope. We also have an enormous amount of material and photographs and so on, and one of our missions in this process has been to provide a DVD or booklet to go out so that if other organizations want to do this, we can steer them around some of the pitfalls, so hopefully adding to their success there. Anna's organization, as I understand it, has been instrumental in trying to collect some funds for the production of those materials. So could it happen that they get into this and not be able to complete it and get stymied? Absolutely, it could. But I guess I would say that if that were to happen, I think I could pledge the Salem Association of Realtors' ability to guide them through.
Okay.
And I would just like to answer that question real quick, if it's okay with you, Mr. Chair.
Please.
Yeah. Representative Gilliam, I guess what I would say is the impediment, the bond requirement, the bill provides a substitute for that bond, and it essentially accomplishes the same thing but doesn't have the guarantee to repay the bond company, if you will. So it still protects the public interest. It just removes that impediment in terms of requiring somebody to put up their personal assets to guarantee repayment of the bond.
Okay.
Thank you. Mr. Prinz, would you like to make a comment? Restate your name, too, please.
Craig Prinz, for the record. I just wanted to answer, I think what Representative Galizia and Representative Gilliam are getting at, which is the certificate of fitness. Until you get that certificate of fitness, you cannot market the home. And to get the certificate of fitness, DHS does chemical testing to make sure that the chemicals that are released during the reactions, that those are cleaned up, and they test it. And what Eric was trying to give you was the technical, how many, it's, you know, way too technical for me, but they do test it. That's the part of the rehabilitation. And DHS does keep a list of contractors that are certified to do that. Not any old contractor can do that type of work. So I think there are safeguards in those two areas that I wanted to make sure the committee knew about.
Thank you. Any other questions from the committee? Thank you very much for your testimony. It's a marvelous thing that you're endeavoring to do for our neighborhoods. At this time, though, I would like to call Craig Smith from the Construction Contractors Board. I could have asked this question, had you sit there and nod, but...
Chair Hovey, members of the committee, my name is Craig Smith. I'm with the Construction Contractors Board.
Thank you, Craig, for making yourself available on this important bill. I just have a couple of quick questions, and I'm sure they're probably pretty easy. But these organizations are still going to be licensed with the Construction Contractors Board?
Chair Holby and members of the committee, yes, according to this bill, this would still require a licensure, but would ease the burden of that personal indemnification for the bond. And this is something that is a burden that, although the board hasn't taken a position on the matter, obviously it's neutral. We haven't taken a vote. It hasn't been brought to us. I think the administration is in full support, as far as I'm aware, of this measure. And the one thing that I wanted to mention is that we, in years past, have had an alternative to the bond for regular contractors, and it became a problem because of bankruptcies. Bankruptcies caused the inability to get to the funds to protect consumers. In situations such as this, you wouldn't anticipate a bankruptcy problem, and I think that's wherein the public policy to allow for a kinder or gentler security probably makes a lot of sense.
So in your opinion, is the ultimate buyer still protected under this arrangement?
I say that they are.
And I have one follow-up question. Thank you. I'm kind of curious if an organization is as under this bill is licensed as a under the CCB and they're waiving this bond, are they just being licensed to perform work without the bonding or with this alternative bond, just on the rehabilitation of illegal drug manufacturing sites that need rehabilitating, or do they have the ability to go out and do other types of construction that aren't involved with illegal drug manufacturing sites?
Okay. Representative Holvey, it's a question I hadn't anticipated. As I understand the bill, this would be just for companies that indicate that they would be doing the rehabilitation of illegal drug manufactured sites.
And so we would likely create a class of contracting that would be specialized to that function. Mm-hmm. Perhaps Craig Prinz would be able to answer that question better than I.
Mr. Chair, that's a good question. I think Craig answered exactly the way I would, that in the section of the bill, line 6, illegal drug manufacturing site, we use the DHS definition of that, and so that we would be only incorporating those that are, when they're deemed an illegal drug manufacturing site, again, they're on those DHS rolls, they're red flagged, basically, that you can't sell one of those until you get it a certificate of fitness. If you look at line 12 of the bill, you can see that that same definition is used, engage in rehabilitating, quote, an illegal drug manufacturing site. So I think that that's what we intended to do, is limit it just to those situations where it is one of the ones that's on the DHS rolls. That's the type of home that could be, that someone could rehab, get a certificate of fitness for without this, with this special bonding requirement.
Thank you for that. I understand that. I'm just concerned that this bill doesn't preclude this nonprofit from engaging in building other construction projects that may not be illegal drug manufacturing sites, and that would cause me some concern. I'd just like to make sure that there's some clarity around that issue, a small statement or something, because I think there's a little bit of vagary around this organization being able to go do other things. It doesn't say it can't. I mean, it says what it's intended to do, I understand that, but it doesn't say that it can't go out and perform as a general contractor and develop a subdivision that has nothing to do with illegal drug manufacturing sites, and therefore, if they were doing that, would they then be required to get a bond? I guess that's kind of where I'm going with that.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we'd be happy to do that with legislative counsel if you'd like to get an that stated. I do know from dealing with legislative counsel in the past, they try to stay away from the situation where you're stating negatives, and I'm sure that's what they did in this situation. I would be happy to pursue that with them, and I have no objection to that.
Yeah. Well, I'd just like that clarified. I think this bill may do it. It just doesn't jump out at me, though. Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, can I make a comment? I think I might have found the answer to your question.
Yeah, I read that too, okay. So I understand that part.
Right.
So I'd like to get legislative counsel's opinion on that.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Anybody else wishing to testify on House Bill 2309? Seeing none, I will close the hearing on House Bill 2309. And I will reopen the hearing on House Bill 2096. And at this time, I would like to have Rick Krager, are you back? And anybody else want to come up with you? No, I guess you're it. Okay.
Everybody's hiding.
Thank you. Please state your name and your organization, if any, for the record. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Rick Krager. I'm the Deputy Director for Oregon Housing Community Services. First of all, I'd like to thank the committee and the staff for accommodating our schedule today with our budget hearings beginning, or the overviews. We do appreciate you accommodating the hearing of this bill. I'm here today to testify on behalf of House Bill 2096, which is a bill developed in collaboration with our local partners to further the preservation of manufactured dwelling parks throughout the state. I believe that Representative Edwards spoke to you earlier, and maybe he provided some of the background and some of the problems that we are facing, but I'm sure many of you are aware that we have over 1,300 manufactured dwelling parks in Oregon, which comprise a very important segment of Oregon's affordable housing. As the land values have continued to escalate, landlords' parks have incentive to sell for profit regardless of the use. Bottom line, this is putting many of the residents in these manufactured parks in jeopardy of losing their home. So the question, what are some of the solutions? Many of you may know Representative Krumbull and the legislature, the 2005 legislature, had passed a law that would help many of the displaced tenants. And certainly Oregon Housing Community Services supports that, and we want to be able to help those residents that are actually moved out of the park. My understanding is Representative Krumbull is looking at some new legislation that would further enhance that bill. And again, we are very supportive of that. But what we offer here in House Bill 2096 is a different way, as a way of actually trying to preserve the park before the tenant is actually moved out. So let me just talk briefly about what 2096 is. It is, I know, a very long bill with a variety of technical changes, and certainly I have staff here that can maybe dive into some of the technicalities if you like, but let me just give you a summary of the major parts of it. Number one, the bill enhances our elderly and disabled bond program to enable the program to supply necessary gap financing. One of the critical pieces to financing a manufactured park is that a private banker, anyone that comes to do the primary financing, can't do the whole loan. So there is going to be a need for some form of gap financing. So with this change, our elderly and disabled program, through the use of tax-exempt bonds, could provide that resource. Secondly, through our department's current loan guarantee program, we could provide up to 50% of the loan guarantee. Currently, again, you have private lenders who may not be willing to jump out immediately to take the risk of financing a manufactured park. Through our loan guarantee program, we could provide guarantees up to 50% that would actually incentivize them to be a primary resource for that. And then lastly, maybe the more complicated piece is the authorization. This authorizes the formation of manufactured dwelling parks, nonprofit co-ops. And again, this is our philosophy here at Housing is they're not trying to invent something here. We're actually copying many what has happened in the New Hampshire, in the state of New Hampshire, where they've actually established co-ops, and these are tenant-owned parks where the tenants collaborate, come in, and actually get the financing to purchase this park. So this would actually provide that opportunity. In closing, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I will state what is reality. There are low-income people living right now in these parks that are at high risk of losing their homes. Some may move, but where is the affordable rent that they are accustomed to paying? Some may relocate their mobile homes, but where is the affordable land to place it? Some may seek federal voucher assistance, but where is the capacity to meet the need? Mr. Chairman, I don't have all the answers to this, but I do offer part of the solution. I believe House Bill 2096 is a good first step to providing opportunities to preserve manufactured parks in the state of Oregon. I would certainly be open for any questions this time, but I do, with your indulgence, Mr. Chair, I understand there was a couple questions to from Representative Edwards. I think Representative Riley had asked a question about right of right first refusal of the residents, and to answer the question, in this particular bill, there is no right of the first refusal. So that's not built into the legislation.
Could I follow up real quickly on that?
Please.
Thank you. Do you know of any legislation pending at this point or that's going to come up this session that offers that right of first refusal?
Mr. Chairman, I think Mr. Van Lanningham, during his testimony, will be able to provide
you
a little bit more information on that. There was one other question from Representative Bonamici. Can residents afford these purchases? And bottom line is that part of this bill with providing the gap financing, that is one of the key pieces to being able to do that. In all cases, it may not work. In certain, particularly in urban areas, the financing may not be there. So it's going to vary, but we do definitely believe that this could be of a value in the urban areas of the state. So I hope that answers your questions, and I'm willing to ask or answer any further questions.
Thank you. Any other questions from the committee? It seems everyone's pretty content, since I already got to ask.
Let's not go that far.
Thank you very much for your testimony on this. It looks like a great program.
Thank you.
Up next, I'd like to call Rick Bennett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Rick Bennett, Director of Government Relations for AARP Oregon. One of the great things about this bill in particular and the testimony is the fact that you've already had somebody like Representative Edwards who's come in and given you a good overview of the issue and the intent, and you have the people here to answer the technical questions, so there's really not too much I have to do other than say I think we're all aware of the issue, the problem that we're concerned with here on House Bill 2096. We've all read the stories that appear in the media when a mobile home park is sold and the buyer chooses to close that park and use the land for some other purpose. And when that happens, I'm sure you hear from your constituents. We hear from our members. And the fact is that I don't think anybody's denying the right of the park owner to access the appreciation and value that's occurred. And but when that decision is made, obviously it creates new decisions that for the residents that can be devastating to their lives. And this bill provides at least one more option for those residents to, instead of moving or abandoning their home, that provides them an option to maintain that home and stay close to their friends and to stay in the community that they're comfortable with and so forth. So, again, we just want to state our support for House Bill 2096. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bennett. Is there any questions from Mr. Bennett? Mr. Bennett, I would appreciate a letter of support of this bill so I can put it in my file so I can remember that you do support this.
You got it.
Thank you. Next up, Mr. John Van Lendingham.
Mr. Chair, could I have Ted Everhart come with me?
You most certainly may. Ted Everhart?
Correct. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is John Van Lendingham. I work as a lawyer at Lane County Legal Aid and Advocacy Center, where I long ago worked with Representative Bonamici before I became elderly, anyway.
very good.
She, of course, did not. She was very young at the time. And I'm testifying on behalf of a group called the Housing Alliance in favor of 2096. I've got written testimony that basically says, good bill, please vote yes. But let me try to anticipate what folks are asking. I know that a lot of legislators are concerned about the mobile home park closure issue. I think I've spent almost all my time on it for the past year or longer working on it. There are a lot of different efforts that you will see in this legislature to try to address different aspects of it. I actually have an email or a memo that I prepared recently trying to list all those things so that you can see we're moving here, 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 and here. And if somebody wants that, I'd be glad to share it. Okay? As Representative Bonamici commented, some parks are on land that is too valuable, cost too much for the residents or anyone else who wants to preserve it as affordable housing to buy it. In that case, there is a group called the Manufactured Housing Landlord-Tenant Coalition. Landlords, tenants, manufacturers, Don Miner is here, others trying to negotiate a package which would compensate in some form those residents who will be inevitably displaced by the closure of those parks. We do not think that we can preserve all parks. That package, that coalition met this morning for probably the 20th time since August of 2005, and we tentatively agreed on a package which we will give to LC tonight in bills that will be introduced by Senator Avakian and Representative Shoffler. That package, roughly speaking, it has about eight elements, but the elements I think that you're interested in would say that in comparison to current law says a landlord can close a park with a 365-day notice and no money. Can give less than that, 180-day notice if the landlord pays $3,500. That's a figure that was set in the 1987 legislature. Almost all landlords use a one-year notice, 365 days, no money. So that's what the current law requires, nothing, essentially. One-year notice, no money. The package will say that the landlord can't give less than 365-day notice, that the landlord cannot charge a demolition or disposal cost for homes that are abandoned. In our experience, some homes cannot be moved and won't be moved in a closure. The tenants will have to walk away from them. And that the landlord will have to pay the tenant $5,000 for a single wide, $7,000 for a double wide, $9,000 for a triple wide. And that half of that payment will have to be given shortly after the tenant gives the landlord notice of a deadline to move out. So the tenant has upfront money to hire a mover, and the other half will be paid right after the tenant moves out. Right now, there is no, as I said, the law doesn't require any money, and there's certainly no upfront money. There is a state tax credit, but that's way retroactive. State tax credit only works when you pay your taxes the year after your park has been closed. So it's not money that you can use to pay for the move. That coalition package will also require that landlords give resident groups, nonprofits, housing authorities, the entities that we think will try to preserve these parks, some of these parks, 60 days to negotiate in good faith. It is not the same thing as a right of first refusal, and I am careful not to use that term because it drives the landlords out of the room. But it is an obligation to negotiate in good faith. It is the model that is used in New Hampshire. The New Hampshire Community Loan Fund has done, as Tadkin's comment, as written testimony describes, has since 1974 fostered 80-some purchases of manufactured housing parks by resident co-ops. It's an incredible model. We're trying to replicate it here. And this bill that you're seeing today is a part of that effort to replicate it. So the other things that we're trying to do to replicate it, besides this package from the Landlord-Tenant Coalition, include bank financing for part of the purchase price. There's a bill. You will see a bill that addresses something called the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit. It's a tax credit that's been in existence since 89. We want to make that usable for park purchases by resident groups, nonprofits, community development corporations, housing authorities, local governments. It's a great financial tool. It allows lenders to lower their interest rates by 4 percentage points. So instead of borrowing money at 8%, you borrow at 4%. So we think that will allow us to borrow part of the purchase price of a park, say up to 80%. The other 20% we're hoping to finance with increased funding to Housing Community Services through the Housing Alliance document recording fee increase. It's Senate Bill 38 that you will see. We're also working with TAD's organization, Community Development Law Center, and a nonprofit, Peter Hanley is here in the back of the room, CASA, to provide technical assistance to work with residents to figure out whether they want to try to do this, and if they do want to try to do it, create a co-op, help that co-op get financing, help that co-op buy the park. So that's sort of a very quick global picture, dirty, to do this. We won't be successful at buying every park. It will be especially difficult in what I refer to as the red-hot markets, the Portland Metro, Bend, maybe Medford, where land is so valuable due to the precious development that it doesn't make financial sense to buy it and preserve it as a park. We can't borrow enough money and then pay it back as a park. But we think over the long run, just as the New Hampshire Community Loan Fund has done over 25 years, that we can make a significant net. The New Hampshire Community Loan Fund has converted more than 20% of its park supply to resident-owned cooperatives, parks. They control their own destiny, and that's what we're trying to facilitate with this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions of Mr. Van Lendingham at this point? And we'll go ahead and hear from Todd Everhart. Tad, excuse me.
Thank you. Chairman Holvey and the members of the committee, thank you for the invitation to be here today. I would simply add to John's testimony.
If you could just state your name for the record.
Tad Everhart.
Thank you.
I would simply add that we are trying to have every type of entity or pattern of ownership available to us in an attempt to preserve this resource of affordable housing. This nonprofit cooperative corporation is a tool that we don't currently have. It's been very successful in New Hampshire. We'd like to have the tool to use in Oregon. We think it'll be successful here. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Everhart. So do we have any questions from the committee of these gentlemen? Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't have any questions. I just want to thank you for your work and explain that you did clarify. My intent in asking the question was to make sure that there are other proposals out there in the event that there is a community that can't raise the funds to purchase. So you did answer that, and I appreciate that.
Thank you. Thank you very much, gentlemen, and Mr. Van Lendingham, you're a credit to Lane County for your work. Is there any?
I just wanted to.
Anybody else that would wish to testify?
Well, I know I don't need to, but I thought I would just so you know what CASA of Oregon is trying to do in relation to this. My name's Peter Hanley. I'm director of CASA of Oregon, and we've recently received some grant money from a foundation that, or actually, it's not a foundation. It's called CFED, but they're trying to organize groups around the states to form resident-owned co-ops. And the Oregon Housing Community Services kindly provided the match money for that grant. And so we're going to be out working with these groups to try and organize them. We were just down in Roseburg, a pretty large park down there of about 300 units, and we did some survey work, and we discovered that about 70% of the people would qualify as low income under the HUD standards. And so we're very supportive of the type of work that we're trying to get accomplished here with this bill, and appreciate your opportunity to testify here before you. We're going to be kind of the glue that holds it all together, working with the financing, working with the state to make sure we have the programs available to the residents of those communities, and then working, trying to get the banks on board to get some traditional financing. The nice thing about this, about manufactured housing parks, is that it's there's not any subsidy in it now from federal or state sources, and we'd like to try and keep it as simple as possible. And by using some guarantees and some other methods, we should be able to preserve a number of these parks and be able to protect these people's homes. So I just wanted to thank you for the opportunity to speak today. Thanks.
Thank you. Any questions?
Don't go away.
Nope.
Representative Riley, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm glad you came up to testify. Is there any thought of trying to have these parks do this even before there's any thought of sale? Are we gonna be proactive and move into this area in advance of the problem?
Representative Chair Colby, excuse me, and Representative Riley, part of our grant is to form a collaboration of folks so that we can be proactive on this. And so there is a resident or a tenant group that we're going to work with to try and get the news out that this is a possibility for them to form their own resident-owned communities. We're only going to work with willing sellers and willing residents. We're not going to try and cram a model down anybody's throat saying, you know, you should really do this. It's going to have to be of their own free will. And so a part of what we're going to try and do is going to do that proactive stuff. Now, we've only got a grant for about 16 months, so it's going to depend on whether some of the Housing Alliance agenda gets passed and we're able to access some of that money, because you're talking a very labor-intensive job here, going out and organizing tenants. We don't do organizing. We construct primarily farm worker housing, and so we're having to hire staff that's going to go out and do this organizing piece. Right now, we're just trying to find out what the statistics are on the folks living in there to make sure that we can access some of the programs that are currently available for these folks. So, yeah, that's our goal, is really to be proactive in way in advance of the park closure.
Thank you.
Any other questions from the committee? Thank you very much for your testimony and your support of this measure.
Thank you.
Anybody else in the audience who would like to testify on House Bill 2096? Seeing none, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2096 and thank all those and that testified on this. Thank you very much. With that, I would like to adjourn this House Committee on Consumer Protection.